A new school year starts as we wrestle with everything from metal detectors to micro schools to morning wokeness. The real kind, not the culture war kind. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we're going to dive into the new school year with a panel of the region's best education journalists and, more important, a teacher. We'll look at urgent security issues like the current metal detectors debate, whether or not we've put the classroom culture wars behind us, the charter and private schools boom, and a new law that may have the little kids starting school at the crack of dawn and let the teenagers sleep in. Put on your backpack and get ready for the bell. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, bienvindo. A new school year is upon us. In Palm Beach and Broward counties, classes start on Monday. In the Keys, they start on Wednesday. And in Miami-Dade County, the first bell rings next Thursday. We make no secret of the fact that education is a priority subject at WLRN. There's a reason our call letters spell out LEARN. So we're devoting this week's South Florida Roundup to a discussion of what lies ahead for our public and private schools in the 2024-2025 campaign. And it's a conversation that's as much about metal detectors as it is about math. You no doubt saw a few weeks ago they finally tore down the building at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, where a gunman massacred 17 students and staff 6 years ago. It was a reminder that school security is an issue we have to get our arms around in South Florida if we're serious about school success. Hence the debate in our school districts right now about how to keep weapons out of the hallways. To examine that and a host of other concerns as school starts, we've invited a panel of the region's top education journalists today. Joining us from the Palm Beach Post is Catherine Kokel. From the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, Scott Travis, and from the Miami Herald, Clara Sophia Daly. Thanks to you all for kindly coming in.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Good to have you. And I want to remind everyone that in the last segment of our show today, we'll be talking to a teacher, a South Florida middle school history teacher, to be exact, to get her crucial perspective on the new school year. And we, of course, would like to hear from you about the all-important subject of our schools. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Scott Travis, let me start with you because your portfolio is primarily the Broward County Public Schools, which is sort of ground zero right now for that school security discussion that's hanging over the start of this new school year. This week, New Broward School Superintendent Howard Hepburn visited South Plantation High School to give folks a demonstration of the district's new metal detectors for all high schools. Let's take a listen.
Before you get to the metal detector, you want to remove these items out of your backpack. You hand it over, you walk through, they hand it back to you. If in any case something else is on you that makes it go off, there'll be a secondary station and there'll be a quick wand just to verify you don't have anything that shouldn't be on you, and you can go on with your day.
So Scott, why did the Broward Public Schools District, the second largest in Florida and the sixth largest in the nation, decide to go the metal detectors route? And I guess the bigger question is, why did Broward decide this was the way to best prevent another Parkland in the future?
Okay, well, this has been discussed at least since the Parkland tragedy, and actually for some time before that. But it really got a lot of attention after the Parkland tragedy. And there was supposed to be a pilot project at Stoneman Douglas that fall in 2018. A security consultant recommended against it, saying that metal detectors provide a false sense of security. Mm-hmm. People were worried at that time about creating a prison-like environment. So it never happened. A year or so later, you get Lori Aladef, who joins the board, and then Debbie Hickson. These are both family members. They're both school board members, right, whose family members died in the tragedy.
That's a good reminder. Thanks. Yeah.
Right. So they were interested in it. And then we get several superintendents. And I think where it really got steam was when Peter Licata became superintendent in 2023. Mm-hmm. He was the superintendent in Palm Beach County. Now, Palm Beach County had decided to try the metal detectors.
Yeah.
And they actually had what was considered a pretty successful rollout of those. And a lot of the fears that people had about them, which was that you're going to have these TSA-like lines stretching out, you know, going for blocks for people waiting to get into school, and then it would take kids an hour to even go through these metal detectors, turned out not to be the case because of the metal detectors that they use. They have a setting on them that allows them to, where a kid can go through them with a cell phone and keys. They don't have to take those out, but it's supposed to catch a weapon.
Right.
And that's sort of, they and Peter Licata used to be at Palm Beach County. Howard Hepburn, the right. current superintendent, also used to be at Palm Beach County. So I think right. that probably Palm Beach County taking the lead on that had a lot to do with why Brower right. decided to do that this year.
So Catherine Kochel, let me turn then north to you in Palm Beach County, where the public schools, as Scott has made clear here, have already been using metal detectors. And as we start a new school year, why do they feel up there that this is still the best way to go to keep weapons out of our schools?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on today. I'm happy to talk about this. The pilot program in Palm Beach County began last summer, and we've got 24 high schools, public high schools up here up in Palm Beach County. And so they rolled them out four high schools at a time. And actually last summer, they started with the biggest high school that has over 2,500 students because they wanted to get kind of that traffic direction matter right. out of way.
And that high school is which?
That is John I. Leonard,
oh, okay.
the central Palm Beach County.
Uh-huh.
And so with this phased pilot program, they were able to kind of work out the kinks and change things. Now that we're starting this new school year, every district-run high school will have metal detectors. It's not just one set. There are several. All of the Palm Beach County high schools have a single point of entry and exit, and both student and staff and visitors to the school all need to go through them. So I wanted to answer those questions mm-hmm. because I had them too last year. You know, are staff going to be doing this too? Are visitors going to be scanned? But like Scott said, these metal detectors have kind of different settings. And the school police chief, Sarah Mooney in Palm Beach County, was able to explain to me last year that they were able to adjust the sensitivity so that, you know, a small metal calculator or a cell phone isn't going to knock, you know, set that
right.
off, and that
right.
not everyone will be pulled aside. But the superintendent gives a kind of a full-throated support of this. They've found it to be very successful. And one of the main reasons for that is that the school police chief says that having the expectation that you will be walking through a metal detector will deter any potential weapons that students bring on campus. If they know, you know, you don't mm-hmm. go through TSA bringing a weapon that you know you can't bring on a plane unless it's a true accident. And so mm-hmm. kind of that mental shift of, if people know they're going to be going through here, they will check their backpacks. They
right.
will,
mm-hmm.
you know, not come into a school campus and be surprised by
right.
a metal detector.
But Clara Sophia Daly, down here in Miami-Dade County, the opinion seems quite different, right? Why has the Miami-Dade County Public School District, Florida's largest and the nation's fourth largest, decided against metal detectors? And what have they opted for instead?
Hi, yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I think
sure.
one important thing to mention is that all of the school board members who I've spoke to are incredibly concerned about school safety.
Oh, sure.
And they haven't mm-hmm. completely, you know, decided against metal detectors. They are just still in conversations to, you know, try and figure out whether or not it would be effective in terms of protecting students, and then also kind of what the cost benefit analysis
right. And they've been citing some studies, right, in recent meetings about the effectiveness of metal detectors, correct?
Yes, yes. And, you know, I think the other thing that, you know, is the case is that they do have some metal detectors that school safety officers will bring into large sporting events and, you know, other kind of high impact activities. And they also have wands that school resource officers use to ensure that, you know, dangerous things are not brought into schools. Another perspective of this, you know, a number of activists who are part of Power U Center for Social Change, which is a nonprofit in Miami-Dade that advocates for low-income Black and Brown students specifically, they are opposed to the school district spending more money on metal detectors because they think it can create, you know, an environment where some students feel actually less safe. And instead, they are trying to advocate for the school district spending more money on restorative justice practices, increasing the number of school nurses in schools, and other things like that.
But one of the alternatives, if I'm not if I'm correct, is that they're discussing in Miami-Dade is some sort of TV screen type of surveillance instead of metal detectors. Is that correct?
Yeah, this is an ongoing discussion, but as of now, no decisions have been made. They're still kind of in the process of deciding, you know, what makes sense.
Okay, no, thanks for clarifying that. Scott Travis, among school security issues, Broward is also wrestling with the question of school resource officers, or SROs, the police officers assigned to each school. There are concerns that reduced funding may force the district to move toward what's called armed guardians instead of SROs, but parents don't seem too pleased about that. Where does this dispute stand now?
Okay, well, I think that's an issue at the moment that's very specific to the city of Pembroke Pines.
Okay, all right.
The school district has an agreement. Now, they tried to do their own police department because the cities were deciding to charge a lot more for school resource officers than they had in the past. But then that did not work out, so they did not have a police department.
Okay.
So the school district negotiated a three-year contract with most of the cities within the county in order to pay a certain rate for the school resource officers. It was maybe about $103,000 per officer with a $5,000 or so increase for the next couple of years.
Right.
So most of the cities agreed to that. Pembroke Pines, at least initially, did not. They said it cost them maybe $140,000, $150,000, $160,000. I can't remember the exact number, to actually have a school police officer. So they wanted the school district to pay the full cost.
Okay.
So the school district said, if we do that for Pembroke Pines, then we'll have to do that for all the other cities.
Uh-huh.
And that's not going to work for us.
Okay.
So what they decided to, what they offered is to provide armed guardians in the elementary schools, and that they would have Pembroke Pines police only provide service in the high schools, and the school district would use their own sworn officers in the middle schools, and they'd use guardians in the elementary schools.
Okay.
Then so they had a meeting this past week, and then a lot of people did not like that idea.
Right. So this is an issue we'll have to keep an eye on then. Catherine Kochel, this may not be a security issue per se, but Palm Beach is perhaps the largest Florida school district that bans cell phone use by students during instruction time, which is actually state law now. No, but is this policy, this cell phone policy, working out for schools? Is it resulting in a better educational atmosphere in the classrooms?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I find it interesting that we're comparing the approach on the police officers in schools among our three counties, because Palm Beach County has its own school district police force. It's the second largest police force in the county after the sheriff's office.
Right.
And this is actually the first year in the last couple of years that every single school will have one of those school police officers on campus.
Mm-hmm.
It is state law, obviously, that an armed guard is on campus. But in years past, Palm Beach County hasn't quite had enough of the school police officers, and they've contracted out with local police agencies to get, you know, a Palm Beach Gardens police officer on a campus. So actually we learned today that this will be the first year in the last 3 years that that every school will have their own, you know, actual school police officer on campus. So always interesting to hear from other counties and see how they're approaching this. But on the matter of cell phones, yes. Palm Beach County students need teacher permission to use earbuds or cell phones in class. We don't have the locking pouches like you may be hearing about in other parts of Florida. But when I talk to teachers, the result is mixed. Some feel like they're babysitting, and they're constantly trying to knock down cell phone use. And others feel like it just provides a blanket rule that helps kids focus better. So, you know, I think it depends on the age. It depends on the students in the classroom. But in general, I hear mixed results. And it is state law now that students are not allowed to use cell phones during instructional time. Right. So,
just quickly, Clara Sophia Daly, what is Miami-Dade's approach to student cell phone use?
Yeah, I also wanted to kind of just quickly also address schools police and mention the fact that Miami-Dade County has the largest schools police department in the nation and, you know, is very proud of that fact. So, that's just something to kind of note in terms of the differences from county to county.
Okay.
In terms of cell phone use, you know, Miami-Dade is following state law. Students can only use cell phones, you know, outside of class. They can have them on school property, but they're not allowed to use them during instructional time, except for if their teacher says, hey, you can, you know, you can use your phone to look something up if it's for like an educational purpose.
Okay.
And then the other aspect of that is that teachers can ask students, you know, hey, put your phone during, you know, in this specific area during class. Teachers do have the ability to ask their students to kind of put their phones in a certain spot in the classroom.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with education reporters Catherine Kokel of the Palm Beach Post, Scott Travis of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Clara Sophia Daly of the Miami Herald about the start of a new school year and the issues it's raising. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I'd like to pivot here briefly to get your perspectives on where we are as a new school year starts regarding the culture wars that have been such a distraction for U.S. schools and especially South Florida schools. I, of course, am not asking you as education reporters to weigh in on the politics of those distractions, whether it's the book banning uproar, the so-called Don't Say Gay law, the arguments about transgender students and student athletes, or the disputes over race and education, like last year's uproar over teaching about slavery. But as journalists, we can't ignore how heavily they've weighed on our schools. So let me just go north to south here. Catherine Kokel, what's the feeling in Palm Beach County? Are schools starting to put the culture wars behind them now?
Sure. I'm seeing a diminishing impact on the discourse and the policies that we're seeing at a school board level and on a school level. And one of the kind of benchmarks of that is that we have an election for there are three district seats up for election this year on the school board. Mm-hmm. And those culture war issues just are not front and center as they were 2 years ago.
That's interesting. No, that's
interesting. So that's kind of the benchmark I use to determine where we're at. And I'm seeing a lot less of it.
Okay.
We did have another round of book challenges here in Palm Beach. All three were denied. It's just not weighing as heavily as it was in recent years.
Scott Travis, what about Broward County, where just last week the school board voted to suspend an employee who let her transgender daughter compete in girls' athletics in violation of Florida's new law. Is the culture wars atmosphere diminishing there as well?
I would say no, it is not diminishing here as of yet, because we had an issue back in October where they were planning a new sex education program. It was extremely contentious and ended up with the school district arresting somebody on a charge that was considered questionable related to to that problem that happened there. But also on the transgender issue, that has been taken up a lot of discussion by the school board in the last few meetings. They could not quite figure out how to deal with that, because there is a state law that says that a transgender female is not allowed to play on girls' sports. And the question that it was known probably a few years ago, because there was a lawsuit, but not a lot of people knew when the lawsuit was filed. Uh-huh. But it came to light probably in October when a school board member received a tip about that, and then there was an investigation and the state got involved and we're expecting swift consequences or extreme consequences.
So still,
so I don't,
Yeah, so still an issue in Broward then, and obviously. Clara Sophia Daly, what's the atmosphere feel like now in Miami-Dade County regarding the culture wars in our schools?
Yeah, I mean, I think some issues, you know, such as whether trans athletes can compete in sports and issues related to, you know, what subjects can be taught and different, you know, issues related to curriculum are still kind of coming up. But it does feel to me like things are calming down a bit in Miami-Dade.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the question of whether chaplains, you know, will be allowed in schools has also
been
a bit of, you know, a culture war issue.
Mm-hmm.
But it does feel a little bit calmer.
Okay. Guys, let's face it, another elephant in the room, as it were, is quite frankly the future survival of public school systems as more and more families opt for charter and private schools, especially now that Florida has made school vouchers available to everyone. Scott Travis, Broward Public Schools are facing a big enrollment decline due in no small part to this. Does it look like a fight the district can win in the long run?
Well, the district believes that it has a new tool that it hopes will help, which is that it just became an A-rated district for the first time in probably 12
right.
years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they're hoping that a lot of the people who chose other options will come back. Whether that's going to happen is still an unanswered question. I believe that they might have better luck with the pre-K level when they're trying to get people to start as opposed to trying to take them away from a school where kids may already be
right.
happy at.
Okay.
So, I was going to say that they are doing an effort to try to close at least five schools. So that right. has been very controversial, and it's unanswered which schools actually be closed, if any.
Catherine Kochel, is declining public school enrollment as big a concern in Palm Beach County?
The short answer to that here is no. Our traditional student enrollment has been growing. It's growing again by 1,000 students this year.
Okay, so sort of the opposite. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, and that is surprising. You know, our school district leaders have said repeatedly that that is surprising. I did an analysis of voucher use in Palm Beach County in February, and found that about 78% of the students who were new to the voucher program were previously enrolled in private schools. So they are not necessarily students who are coming from our private schools, I'm sorry, from our public schools to our private schools, but rather families who are already in the private school system that are taking advantage of that FES scholarship.
That is interesting. And Clara Sophia Daly, I know you're working on a reporting project about the impact of the new state law expanding voucher access to any Florida family. How do you see this reshaping the relationship between public schools and their private, charter, and micro schools counterparts? Does it also threaten Miami-Dade's public school enrollment?
Yeah, so this year we are expecting about a 4,000 student decline in enrollment. But kind of the biggest way that we're seeing the Miami-Dade public schools kind of being impacted by vouchers is that the per student funding in Miami-Dade has not increased from the state, you know, as much as the school district would have liked. It hasn't really even kept up with, you know, the increasing costs of inflation.
Mm-hmm.
And as the state continues to fund more and more vouchers, it'll be interesting to see how the state funding, you know, for public schools is impacted. I was looking today at an analysis from, you know, the state that basically projects what the voucher use is going to look like over time. And it looks like it will increase, like they're predicting that voucher use in the state will increase around 66% between last school year and the 2029 to 2030 school year from
that's significant.
4,938 to 607,313. Yeah. So yeah, like a pretty significant increase.
Yeah. But Clara Sophia, one of the things experts feel could make up for that South Florida public school enrollment decline is the boom we're also seeing in immigration. In the 2022-2023 school year, for example, Miami-Dade saw more than 20,000 new immigrant students enroll, especially from Venezuela, Cuba, Haiti, and Nicaragua. Are they the student population that will perhaps keep public education's classrooms full here for the, or fuller for the foreseeable future?
Yeah, so it's hard to kind of predict like immigration trends, but it seems to be slowing down a bit for now. Of course, the school district still sets aside extra money in their budget for these populations in the case that, you know, something happens and there is an increase of, you know, students coming from other countries. And the superintendent has absolutely gone and advocated at the state level for additional funding to, you know, help with that.
Yeah.
But it does seem like, you know, it's the number of immigrant kids are slowly coming down.
Now, Scott Travis, is that phenomenon playing out in Broward County as well? Declining public school enrollment being perhaps counterbalanced by newly arrived immigrant students?
I think there's growing immigrant population, but I don't think it comes anywhere close to balancing out. They've had enrollment declines of 3,000 to 4,000 students per year. Generally, what happens when you have these enrollment declines is that a lot of the school district has more of certain types of students, and that would include students that are limited English proficient, students that are special needs. A lot of these populations, the school districts tend to serve a lot more than charter and private and home schools do.
Okay. Catherine Kochel, I just want to check with you as well about the impact, if any, of the boom in South Florida immigrant students for Palm Beach County. Are you seeing it up there as well, particularly, let's say, in the Haitian community, which I know is pretty sizable up there?
Absolutely. Yeah. About 10% of the students, of the 170,000 public school students in Palm Beach County, come from Haitian households. And the school district is actually rolling out its dual language Haitian Creole programs. I got to sit in on a class, a kindergarten class, last school year, and it is just remarkable to see. So there's new programs, new opportunities that I think will continue to evolve as immigrant populations and immigrant communities continue here.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that, because I know one of the big things going up on in Palm Beach County is the incorporation of Creole language instruction in classes like math, for example, to help newly arrived students do better in those subjects in their native language. Is that something that stands out for you as well up there?
Absolutely. And it's remarkable to see the difference in comprehension when students are at least experiencing the language that they speak at home at points during the day in the school day. And it boosts their comprehension in English, too, when they're in dual language programs. So it's remarkable.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with education reporters Catherine Kochel of the Palm Beach Post, Scott Travis of the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Clara Sophia Daly of the Miami Herald about the start of a new school year and the issues it's raising. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. I wanted to sort of end our discussion here actually looking ahead to the 2026-2027 school year, if I may, guys, when a new state law is set to go into effect that would appear to invert the daily school starting time for primary and secondary school students. There's long been a debate about whether high school students should be the ones starting the day at like 7:30 a.m. when they tend to go to bed much later at night than elementary school students do. Let's listen to Harneet Walia. She's the director of sleep medicine at Baptist Health's Miami Cardiac and Vascular Institute.
Teenagers generally have a tendency to sleep late and wake up late, and this will allow the kids to get an adequate amount of sleep. And we know that good quality and good quantity of sleep is very important for proper functioning. So this is backed up by a lot of scientific evidence to push the school times to a later hour.
And so the new law would, in fact, now have Florida teenagers starting later when experts say their brains are fresher, and perhaps have the little ones start earlier, especially since elementary and secondary school bus schedules would have to be switched. Clara Sophia Daly, how has this new legislation been greeted by families and schools in Miami-Dade? Or do you think even people are even aware about it now? Does it make sense to education experts?
Yeah, I think that it's been, you know, something that people are discussing. You know, high school students who are doing outdoor sports would be out in the sun later on in the day. So it might be, you know, a little bit less intense for them. You know, obviously South Florida is quite hot.
Yeah.
You know, Some parents say they like the idea of kids starting later because, you know, some of the kids drive themselves and they feel more comfortable having their children drive during the daylight. So these are kind of some of the things that we're hearing, but, you know, we'll see what kind of happens as things move on.
Scott Travis, has this new start time regimen proposal been, or not proposal, it's law now, been met with approval, disapproval, or indifference there in Broward County?
I believe it's been disapproval. We did a story, I did not do it, but I remember reading it, where the Broward School District was filing and some kind of appeal or exemption so that they could try to get out of that. And I don't know what the status of that is. I know this issue also came up when the school board was discussing whether they wanted to have more schools like Pompano Beach High School, which meet for longer days, but only 4 days a week. They meet Monday through Thursday, and it's been a very successful model at that particular school. And when they were talking about whether expanding it, one of the issues that they might have is that if you're going to have a longer day anyways, and then you're not going to be able to start your day until 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, whatever the time was, what they said, you're going to be getting really late in the day, and it's going to affect kids who are trying to do jobs after school and stuff like that. So there's definitely a downside to it. I've heard the same support for it as far as the reasons are, but it's definitely not universally accepted.
Oh, that is really interesting. Catherine Kochel, what's the reception been like up in Palm Beach County to this idea that it's the high school kids who should be starting the school day later, when their brains, their teenager brains, are fresher, and the little kids should be starting, you know, at 7:30 because they're the ones going to bed earlier?
Well, I think any parent of an elementary school student will tell you they're up and at them early.
Exactly.
We've all been there.
Exactly.
I think the concern here is, because Palm Beach County needs to change middle and high school to start times, that everything needs to change. I mean, our buses run, you know, each level of school back to back to back. And so without doubling or tripling the number of bus drivers, which we know has been a challenge to even maintain the current force, some of Palm Beach County's plans, you know, their proposals have middle school students starting at 10:15. And so if a normal workday starts at 9, you're talking about a pretty significant investment needed in before and after school programs for middle school students.
That's when journalist days start.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a good point. And so the phased in busing is really going to create a problem here. And, you know, there are these three proposals in Palm Beach. I think, you know, I know from talking to school district leaders that they're planning some pretty significant outreach to get parents' thoughts on this, but they are also kind of hoping that they can mobilize that parent input and get some sort of an exemption. I can't say whether that will work, but I know several of the large urban school districts are looking at this and looking at the bus situation and thinking, I don't know that there's a way we're going to make this happen. So
right.
A lot of concern here. Well, and we'll see what happens.
Well, as I said, we've got 2 years to hash all this out, right? Catherine Kochel is education reporter at the Palm Beach Post. Scott Travis covers education at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. And Clara Sophia Daly covers it at the Miami Herald. Many thanks to you all, and enjoy school this year.
Thanks so much for having us.
We're devoting today's show to the start of South Florida's new school year next week. We just finished a great discussion with the region's education reporters about some of the biggest issues we're facing in the academic campaign ahead. But we can't forget that the real education experts are teachers. And so to end the program today, we wanted to sit down with a South Florida educator, someone who's in the classroom trenches every day, getting the world's most important job done, and done well. In the studio now, we are honored to have an exemplary South Florida educator with us. Sylvia Villasis is a world history teacher at West Miami Middle School, a magnet school on Coral Way by the Palmetto Expressway, right? And what is the mascot for West Miami Middle School?
Golden Falcons.
Go Golden Falcons. All right, Sylvia, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
If there's anything you want to ask Sylvia, or if you just want to say thanks to teachers, call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Sylvia, I'm especially glad to be talking to a history teacher, not just because that's one of my favorite school subjects, mm-hmm. but because history is one of those subjects that helps kids become better citizens. And that's really important in the hyper-polarized social media misinformation world we live in today, when our sense of citizenship, our sense of civics, seems to be challenged every day. I just finished a good book by New York Times columnist Frank Bruni titled The Age of Grievance, in which he points out that, quote, our schools need to do much better with civics education because Americans of all ages today fail basic civics literacy tests at staggering rates. Mm-hmm. As I said, that seems to make your particular task as a history teacher all the more important, especially when we've got a historic election coming up in November. I know you're going to be talking a lot about it when classes start next week. What is the most important thing to teach students at such an important citizenship moment like the one we've got coming up?
I think it's very important to... I was listening earlier to your show, and I was noticing this talk about the immigration and the metal detectors. Mm-hmm. And in the school where I teach, West Miami, most of our students are ESOL level ones and twos.
ESOL being English as a second language.
Correct. Uh-huh. And they're part of what our student body, what we've noticed in the school is that our student body population is increasing and it's becoming more immigrant based.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And one of the challenges that I think is these are students that are coming sometimes fresh, you know, into the country.
Yeah.
Some of them have even experienced crossing the border. They don't know anything about our government, our way of life, our educational yeah. system.
And a lot of them are, let's say, from Venezuela recently, where
or
a
Cuba.
Country where we've just seen the dictator president steal an election. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And they don't know how things work. And so I think one of my concerns as a history teacher is helping them assimilate into this country, but also the public school education. I think that's one of the challenges that we face, how to better assimilate them, because for example, last year, one of my challenges was that I kept on getting a continual trickle in of new students into my class.
Yeah.
And so when they come in, I teach eighth grade, which by eighth grade, you're supposed to have already taken U.S. history in sixth,
uh-huh.
seventh grade civics,
mm-hmm.
where you explain government and all that. And then, of course, eighth grade is what I teach. You teach world history.
Mm-hmm.
And they already missed the community creating activities. They already
right.
missed my expectations and the rule. You know, I take the first 2 weeks of school to work on that, to create a community of learners, to make them feel at home.
Mm-hmm.
And when they come in, throughout every 9 weeks, they're trickling in, and that's a challenge, because they don't know. It's like a fish being pulled out of one
right.
lake into a whole totally different,
and just bringing just the simple act of bringing them up to speed has got to be daunting.
And I think that's the biggest challenge. And yeah. some students are ready, they're ready for the challenge, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit, there are some students that they thrive on that challenge of being in a new place, a new beginning. But then there's always a handful of them that they don't want to be there.
Right.
They don't want to learn. Why do we have to learn this? Why is history important?
Mm-hmm.
So I have to be able to cater to them as well.
And as you said, a lot of them are ESOL or English as a second language students. This would seem to be a big advertisement for promoting bilingual education.
Correct.
Where we are then too.
Correct.
Becomes very important. Sylvia, when we talk about that increased diversity in our South Florida classrooms, teachers have also had to wrestle in recent years with the culture wars, especially when it comes to subjects like gender and race. I know history teachers like yourself have been particularly caught up in those issues, a good example being the uproar last year over how to teach the history of slavery in this country. How difficult has all of that made your job as a teacher in recent years?
How difficult it's made my
job. The whole culture wars atmosphere that particularly, as I said, history teachers like yourself have had to deal with in the last few years.
I don't think it's really affected me. I mean, I just, because it's in the curriculum, it's in our objectives, our standards, and it's part of what we have to teach. You know, when I taught American history too, 2 years ago, I taught American history, and that's sixth grade. You have to cover the Civil War, the lead up, the causes and effects of the Civil War. So I haven't had any particular problem with it.
Oh, good.
And there's a lot of resources that you could use that the district provides. So I don't think I've had an issue with that, in the classroom at least.
So you feel that then perhaps, you know, at least in this upcoming school year, that the whole culture war's temperature then maybe has been brought down a bit in this region anyway?
Yeah, I think what the biggest thing now is that I learned recently that we got new books, we got new textbooks. The district adopted new textbooks, and I learned that, and it was sad to know that the African American history is not there. Like, it's not, the chapter is not there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that's something that we used to teach in world history. We used to teach, because my subject focuses on ancient civilizations.
Uh-huh.
And so we cover the Greeks, the Romans, the Chinese, Indians, and South America.
Mm-hmm.
But when it came to Africa, they only cover Egypt, for example, which is part of North Africa.
Okay.
And so that's a disappointment to know that. Well, that was totally bypassed.
That's something I think education reporters here would want to look into. I also know that as a teacher, Sylvia, you're very mindful of the security issues swirling around our schools as the new academic year starts. We talked with our education reporters panel earlier about things like metal detectors and school resource officers and even student cell phone use. But what do teachers like you, who are really the first line of defense between students and security threats in our schools, what do you feel are the biggest security concerns we should be thinking about?
I don't think when I heard about the idea of metal detectors and what Broward was doing, I really thought, I don't like the idea, because I think that we already have, I don't like it because it's, I don't think it's really necessary. We don't have a dire need. And I'm basing my opinion on the fact that recently they installed cameras in my school.
Mm-hmm.
And I think other schools in the district, I think, did the same. And
I should point out that the metal detectors idea is really just for high schools, not for elementary and middle schools like the ones you teach. But still, as a middle school teacher, you know, do you feel that the really important security issues are being addressed?
I'll tell you what I feel. I feel safe in my school.
Okay.
Okay. We have every year we do a school climate survey every year. Not only we ask students, we ask parents, we ask teachers, even admin. They all have their own survey that they take. It's a qualitative survey. And everything is pointing, at least in my school, that we feel safe. We don't think we need it. And what I was saying earlier, we put the cameras. We have police personnel that report to the school. We even had dogs come in and do regular random checks of classrooms to make sure they don't have any, you know, illegal substances in their book bags. And that's already been in place. So I honestly don't think that we have to take it to that extreme of bringing in the metal detectors. I think, honestly, if you ask my opinion, I think they should use that money because it's going to be pretty expensive to invest in that type of technology. But I think they should use that money to invest it in maybe more health, more mental health programs.
And I want to get to that issue with you right now. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with West Miami Middle School history teacher Sylvia Villasis about the sometimes heavy challenges she and her profession face in the new school year that starts next week. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. So, Sylvia, I want to turn to a broader issue here for teachers, one that I discussed earlier with the Education Reporters panel, and that's the question of whether public schools like yours even have a future, given the swing we're seeing to private and charter schools. Do you fear that public education is in a struggle to survive?
Not any more than public broadcasting does.
Good point. But I really wanted to go back to that issue you were just raising before our little break there. I also wanted to ask you about, speaking of mental health, about the students you teach, that is middle school students. And I have a sort of personal stake in this because my late mother was a middle school English teacher. And we used to joke that what made her so good at her work was the fact that she actually treated junior high students as human beings and not this inscrutable life form evolving between childhood and adolescence. But in seriousness, we know that the social and mental health pressures on the particular age group of kids you teach are even greater today than they were in my mom's day. How do you approach that reality as a teacher today, Sylvia?
About
just the mental health pressures that kids, like you were saying, that we should be spending more money on mental health efforts in schools like yours rather than metal detectors, for example.
I think we could do a better job. I mean, I think if we were able to get police officers present in schools, I think we should take more mental, we should have more like nurses or counselors mm-hmm. present in the school. And I think that's important because a lot of these, a lot of the students population that I teach, for example, I know they've gone through a very traumatic experience coming to this country and what's being done for them, you know? And we expect them to sit in our classrooms and then we have to and do good on a test and what about their mental health, you know? Mm-hmm. they have to process that. They have to process that trauma.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of people, for example, they have parents that are in their home country and the kids are here on their own or with a loved one or a grandparent or an aunt mm-hmm. or something or someone, and I just think we could do better on that area.
That's a very important point, and I'm glad you brought it up. Sylvia Villasis is a world history teacher at West Miami Middle School. Sylvia, thanks very much, and best of luck this year.
Thank you for having me.
Finally on the roundup, another school story everybody's talking about here.
Went from Mr. 305, Dade County, to Mr. Worldwide, all around the world.
Hey, hey.
And now, international.
And now Mr. Florida International, as in Florida International University. This week, FIU announced a multi-year, multi-million dollar partnership with Mr. 305 himself, Miami rapper and Cuban-American entrepreneur Armando Perez, better known as Pitbull. That deal includes renaming FIU's football venue Pitbull Stadium. Here's Pitbull at a press conference on Tuesday.
This is history in the making. You're going to see that every other university is going to want to do the same thing. But the difference is we don't do this for propaganda. We do it from the heart. We do it because it's meaningful. We do it because I'm from the crib. I'm 305. I'm from the bottom. This is my backyard, and Miami is ours.
According to FIU, Pitbull will pay the school $1.2 million per year for 5 years with an optional 5-year renewal. Pitbull will also create a new anthem for the school, whose mascot, by the way, will remain a panther, not a pit bull, and he'll be named the, quote, official entrepreneur of FIU athletics. The 21st century college sports business model has come to the 305. That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. It's produced by Jimena Romero with help from Polly Landis. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news, the vice president of radio, and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. Richard Ives answers the phones. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.